Thank you, Ian. Forgive me for being patriotic this week. We need all the help we can get. This is a difficult few weeks for Canadians, but the only medal we're ever remembered for was taken away because of steroids. I didn't get a chance. I was in Holland. I didn't get a chance to see the opening ceremonies. I've read a fair bit about them, and a magnificent show after 7 years and 27 million pounds. Danny Boyle got to make the movie he always wanted to make. And it was an incredible story, wasn't it? What a daunting task. Can you imagine this, trying to tell the story of this land to people, was it 1 billion people all over the world? And of course, I mean, it was necessarily subjective. And the critics now, of course, are going to weigh in on was it really the story that should have been told? Were the right things highlighted? Were the wrong things emphasized? But at the end of the day, what I've been able to gather so far is it moved you, particularly you. I mean, it was impressive for others. But for you, it was different, because for you, it was your story. And there's something about our story that it defines us, that captures us. And that's really what I want to try to talk about this week, is the whole, not just the concept of story, but our story. A story is, of course, always capture us, always move us. Because every one of us live our lives in a story. Stories are how we explain how life works. Stories, but it's not just the practical things it's more than just practically how life operates and what are the boundaries and how you stay out of trouble and how do you stay in favor, but more so, it's stories that call out our deepest longings and dreams and give them some explanation and meaning. But stories are never neutral. Stories are always inviting us. In fact, in any culture, in any period of history, there's a whole number of different kinds of narratives, aren't they? And they're all calling to us from the youngest ages, sometimes reinforced by millions of advertising dollars saying, believe me, live in me. And it's in me, in my explanation of all the things that happen around you and to you, you're going to find meaning and fulfillment. So all of us choose a story, and then we live in it. What about ours? What about our story? What about the story that has caused all of you to take a week of your holidays and come and camp? Now, I'm displaying some people accuse me from time to time from reading my own personality into my messages and my exegesis. But, you'll come, and regardless of the weather, even though this is probably disappointing weather for you so far. Well, we all feel we need a certain amount of adversity in our life, and it forms the character of Jesus. So it's been my understanding that's why you come and again every year. But what about our story? Of course, one of your own brilliant theologians has described it this way. He said, well, it's a grand sweeping story that tells of the creation of heaven and earth. I mean, you got to love a story that begins in the beginning and comes right through the tragic disintegration and separation of these two realities all the way to their eventual reuniting. And of course, for us, the pivotal and dramatic event is this sudden entry, astonishing entry, death and resurrection of Jesus, the one that gives, well, practical application for us to the story. But he goes on to say, because this is not just some kind of dry academic treatise, a historical survey. No, it's a book that tells everything like it really is. It's amazing, actually, they let children read this book. We'll talk more of that later. But he goes on to describe it as a big book with big characters. They have big ideas, not least about themselves, he says, and they make big mistakes. And then in some magnificent alliteration, he says, it's about God and greed and grace. It's about life, lust, laughter, and loneliness. About birth, beginnings, and betrayal. It's about siblings, squabbles, and sex. About power and prison. And prayer and passion. And then he goes on to say, that's just Genesis. I remember one time, we were already married. I'm not sure if I'd ever read the Bible from the beginning to the end. And we were actually going to get a little adventure. We went to Europe and we wanted to spend as little money as possible and stay as long as possible. We got ourselves a VW van and by the mercy of God somehow got it registered and I think drove legally on the roads. And then we began to sort of find our way. And during this period of 4 months, I decided I would read the Bible from the beginning to the end. And so I started. You know, it starts. I mean, it's amazing. It doesn't take long. There's not a lot of opening credits. Right away, you're into these two naked people running around this incredibly climate-controlled garden. And I'm already wondering, if I visualize this, would it be a sin? But it seems so amazing. They're in love with one another. But talk about a book that moves quickly. Within a page, they need marriage counseling. And there's nowhere to go. I mean, they have kids, but within a few chapters, the kids are killing each other. You know, and you go, this isn't even the modern era. I mean, we don't even have drugs yet. And within five chapters, I was on antidepressants. You start flipping, and then you start reading ahead quicker and quicker. Anybody ever read the Bible? You know what I'm talking about? And you hear this little sound in the background. It's like the sound that you would have heard during the Second World War, the sound of an airplane going down. And you're just waiting for the, you know, and you go, this book isn't even gonna get out of Genesis, let alone, and you start flipping ahead to whole sections. And you go, still depressing, still depressing. Oh, a little bit hopeful, really depressing, you know. And then I did what I'm sure a lot of you have done. You flip to the very end because you go, I mean, this is bigger than War and Peace. And if this doesn't end well, you know, I'm going to rent a DVD of something. Well, if you've ever, I mean, it ends really well, doesn't it? And so you go back and slog through Genesis a little more, kind of going, how in the world does it get there? I mean, there's a few hopeful signs. And then after that, you just read some story. I remember when I quit reading, was when I got to the story of the guy who made a vow, a stupid vow, that if he won a battle, if God honored him, he would sacrifice the first thing he saw. I thought, this guy does not think ahead much, right? And then, it's like, you know, you're reading the story and you're just going, this is not going to end well. This is not going to end well. And sure enough, he meets his daughter. I tell you what, if I was God, I would have toasted the guy right there. Right? Have you read this book? And I don't know when it was that I actually got it. That there was a story behind the story. That the surface plot was not the point. I don't know when I realized, but I started realizing, hold it. I looked from all the bad spots, you know, that I'd been to, and I went, God was there. God was there too. God's still there. And then I began to recognize the real message. This God is simply determined to never give up on us. In the worst of times, when we do the most horrible things and then assign it to him, he still wouldn't run. He would not abandon us. And of course, that's what people begin to recognize was, one of the two dominant themes to this entire great story. This roller coaster story up and down, and yet threaded to it, through it are two amazing comforts. The first being, God determined very early on, he would not give up on this thing that he had made, but that he was going to put it right. And then secondly, even more miraculously, that he was determined to put it right one person at a time through people that hear his invitation, through the power of love alone, that he would reconcile us to himself and then with us go and change the world. So we can read stories in the Old Testament and the New. A classic one in the New Testament is Luke 19, when this short guy climbs a tree, had no idea what he had just bitten off. And he sees Jesus, but Jesus sees him. And this theme of the story comes and gathers him up and captures his heart and says, all of the story was designed to meet you today. Has that been your experience? Was there a time, someplace, somewhere, and it seemed like the whole story stopped and it reached and it saw you, and then love beckoned and said, will you trust me? You want a story to live? Take a step. Of course, for Zacchaeus, that one step was out of a tree, and by the time he came to, he'd given away half his stuff, right? And found it an amazing privilege, because someone, something, had spoken into the center of who he was and called him into a story worth giving his life for. Perhaps all stories are active, never passive, but this one especially so. This is a story, the story that we call the Bible, which wants to not only encounter us, but capture our hearts, absolutely disarm us, not with coercion or threats, but with love, and lead us to a place that on our own we never would go, never could go. I think perhaps the last time I was here in another setting, I made the comment, if I didn't, I'll make it now, that the only thing really that surprises me about this story is, number one, that they'll sell it anywhere. I mean, they'll sell it in stores where children can go. But secondly, they'll sell it to unsuspecting adults like you and I without any kind of warning advisory sticker on it. I mean, they have that, don't they, on CDs and things like that? They should have that on Bibles. It should be a big, stark warning, danger. This is the story of God's love reaching for you. And then an even bigger writing, it will kill you. Because it will. It's what it intends to do. It wants to take one of the greatest values in our present culture, and that is our control over ourselves, or at least the illusion of our control over ourselves, and it wants to invite us to give it all away and to trust love instead. You know, someone mentioned this morning that in our leaders' prayer times in the morning, one of the things we're going to talk about is Ezekiel 47. That's a fantastic, very familiar. For those people who only read little snippets of the Old Testament, it's one of those great images of a river that comes out of the throne of God. Now, maybe it's less popular in England. You don't want to sing sort of rain on me songs or really even water metaphors don't sort of grab your heart in the same way as it would if you lived in the desert. But for any of you that have been to Israel and been at all south or east of Jerusalem, you know exactly how this image would have grabbed their hearts. This presence of God, the character of God, and out of it comes life. Comes love, all the things our heart, our thirsty hearts long for. And in this image, this water comes, and being Christian water as it is, it immediately stops right in the vicinity of Jerusalem and builds magnificent pools where we can come and refresh ourselves and have renewal meetings. And it has sort of, you know, waterfall backdrops for the worship bands, a place where we can stay near to Jerusalem forever and just soak up the fact that love has come to us and found its rest in us. Does that, anyone read Ezekiel 47? Ezekiel 47 more so reads like this. As they're setting up the worship bands and they're starting to construct the next sort of set of pools, it's sort of, you know, the water molecules look at each other, just like water molecules always do, and say, you know, if we make a break for it now, we might escape. Because you see, as much as love has yearned to come to me and to come to you, as soon as it does, it remains restless. It's the very nature of water. I mean, if I poured out, I almost hesitate to even use these analogies because it might be a prophetic sign that'll invite something, but if you pour out water on a hard floor, it doesn't just circle around in a tight little concentric gathering and begin to speak to one another saying, I love you with the love of the Lord. And I'm not criticizing that. I mean, these are wonderful, special times. Man, did I ever enjoy the worship. I just walk in and the sound, something happens, doesn't it? That's so healing, so, it just makes you want to be a Christian all over again. And so I'm not denigrating that. I'm just saying that having come here immediately, this water poured out will be looking for the door. And it'll be looking for a place outside of England. And it'll keep searching, it'll keep moving until either it exhausts itself or it gets to the lowest and the furthest place that it can reach. It's what water always does, and it's what the gospel has always done. It's what this story has always strived to do. It wants to go to the Dead Sea, but it wants to take us with it. I'm not saying we can't control it. I'm not saying we can't constrain it. I'm not saying we can't create a pool or a pond. But as soon as we do, something desperately begins to be lost. And then we seek to somehow revitalize those settings. And yet this story is saying the answer is something different. The story has always acted this way. I mean, we can read in the New Testament one of the classic chapters where we read of love, the story of love encountering an individual is in Acts chapter 9. It's one of my favorite stories. At this time, the man's name is Saul, and he's actually feels like he's in a really good place. You ever felt at one time you were in a really good place and then you sort of bumped into God and got a slightly different perspective? That's happened to me a number of times. So I can identify with what's happening here. He's riding towards Damascus, and I don't know what kind of conversation he's having with God, but I imagine it's something like this. He's probably saying, you know, God, there's kind of no one like me around, man. I mean, I'm really putting my money where my mouth is. I am defending your honor. I'm going after those blasphemers, those followers of this guy named Jesus who has ruined the whole story. Yes, no, I understand. I know how angry you get about this. But I am here to defend your name. You can depend on me. I'm carrying this story forward. In fact, I don't know. What would you say if you met me right now? I mean, if I had a sudden experience, would it be, well done, Saul? And while this sort of daydream is going on, his wish is fulfilled. Bam! He's flat on his back. He heard this sound like thunder. He's blinded, and he hears a voice. Now, this is a theologically educated man. He understands that what's going to happen to him has rarely happened in his period of history. There's been about three different rabbis that have had these sort of encounters with God in Saul's lifetime or memory. One of them died on the spot. It is not, I mean, it's risky. coming face to face with a righteous God. The other one went absolutely crazy. And the third one wrote a killer series of books, sort of Left Behind. No, it wasn't that. The third one lived to write and tell about it. You know, I saw God and lived, that sort of thing. So Saul's thinking, what's it going to be? What's it going to be? What's the voice going to say? And it starts off, well, Saul. And he goes, he knows me, right? Why are you persecuting me? Have you ever, maybe a rainy day going down the M1, And suddenly you realize that you were going a little too fast and you are now going in circles. You ever had that experience? It's very fascinating. You'd think it would go really quickly, like, ah! Instead, it's very slow and peaceful. It's like, I am about to die. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Way back there, probably the speeders, you know. Amazing, you drive fast to get everywhere late, right? We'll have a ministry time for that later. But it's amazing. So here he is, he's got a short list of people he's persecuting. And he's going, this could be a problem. And then the voice continues. Next he goes, who are you? Lord, because if you're the Lord, and this is a theological term, I'm toast, right? And then he hears, just like to introduce myself, I'm Jesus. We didn't have a chance to meet, you weren't born yet, but, and then he knows his life is over. He didn't mean it to be, but he became the enemy of God. And the only thing that's uncertain to him is not whether he will die, it is how he will die. Because he's read the story. He realizes that God has a number of different options. I mean, God could send down fire from heaven, and that would be quick. And then he's flipping. God could open up the earth and swallow him. I wonder what's down there. And then he goes, oh no. God could send a lion to eat him. And he's praying for fire. Right? And what happens next? He could have never anticipated. He had nothing in his grid. Oh, he's killed. God kills him, all right. But kills him with love and mercy. He says, Saul, come on. Let's get up. Let's go change the world. And if you've ever read any of Saul's letters, He never recovers. He can't talk about any word that starts with L without just starting to blubber. You read the letters? That's what it's like, isn't it? In fact, Galatians 2, how does he describe it? He says, you know what? I died that day. Verse 19. And at that point in time, the life I have now was a gift. So this life is for love. This life is for the cause of whatever love wants to do in the world. This life is a gift. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And 2 Corinthians is an interesting letter. I mean, Paul's having to defend a lot of why he's doing what he's doing, his authority to do it, and he's appealing to them in many different ways. But it seems that one of the things that they've said to Paul, his name is now Paul, they're saying, Paul, like, lighten up a little bit. You make us feel guilty. I mean, take a day off for crying out loud. I mean, take up golf or something. Like, just do something other than work, work, work. And they seem to be asking the question, what drives you, Paul? And Paul reflects on that. And in verse 14, he seems to respond this way. He says, you know, I would call it more pulled than driven. Because you see, it's not guilt. I understood all the things before that drove me. These competitive things to get God's pleasure and his approval. But no, this is different. Something hooked into my heart that day when I heard this message. And it's pulling me still. I can't help but follow it. See, it's the love of Christ that compels me, he said. Eugene Peterson describes it this way in his translation called The Message. He says, Christ's love moves me to such extremes. In fact, it has the first and last word in everything I do. And this is what the story has always done. It's what it's always longed to do. Sometimes we're pulled out of the story for a variety of reasons, but if you've known Jesus, you know what I'm talking about. There was a day and time when love captured your heart, and at that point in time, you wanted to trust it completely and were willing to go wherever it went. You were like Abram and Sarah said, wanted to print up a t-shirt saying, "No, I don't know, but I'm going." Right? And then life gets in the way and things happen. But every once in a while, we sing a song, we hear a message, we read a text, we get too close to the story again. Something starts to pull us in. What happens at that point? This is what the story has always done. I mean, we could go to New Testament, Old Testament examples. We could look throughout church history. I mean, right at the end of the 12th, beginning of the 13th century, right at maybe 13th, 14th, right at the emergence of a rising scholasticism, a rigid theological system where they're dotting their I's and crossing their T's and dotting your T's and crossing your I's too. And at that point, this young man, Francis, has an encounter in the church in San Damiano. And love pierces his heart. And he understands for the first time that the God of this story wants to possess him. And he literally strips off all his old clothes in this season of time, and he gives himself to this river of love to the end of his days, trying to live it out so that he might be a testimony to love in all things. A few years ago, I was traveling in Europe, and I went to this beautiful city of Prague in their spring musical festival. Have you ever been there? They've got musicians everywhere, and the architecture is amazing, and the weather was good, and we were having this delightful time. And then on the way back, we were flying out from another city in Europe. We drove, I don't know if you've ever done this, but we drove east in the Czech Republic, right through that little corner where Poland and Germany and the Czech Republic meet, to a little village. The village is called Herrnhut. And if you know any of the history of Herrnhut, you know that what happened it came out of the life of the reformer, Jan Hus, and he was, of course, burned at the stake, but there were people that heard his message, and this message pierced their hearts, and it caused them, at whatever cost, to follow this message and to try to live it out. They tried to enter into the story. And of course, initially, there was some protection because of the political realities of that time and protection of the princes around them. But then in the 1620s, sometime yet later, almost 100 years later, at the time of the Counter-Reformation, the tide changed. They were hunted, they were pursued, they were put to death. They went underground and dispersed all through Eastern Europe. And then, about 100 years later, there was a man, a privileged man, an aristocrat. His name was Zinzendorf. And he was captured by the story. And by a God who wanted to encounter him, a God who wanted to relate to him, and a God who wanted to draw the whole world into his love. And he looked around and he saw what aristocrats never saw in his time. He saw the persecuted, he saw the outcast, he saw the alien, he saw the poor. And he determined in his heart he would create a refuge for them. And so he gathered this group of what we've came to be known as the Moravians, at that time were called themselves the unity of the brethren. So he brought these separated brethren and he brought them into this little village to celebrate unity with one another so that the love of God, the water of God could come together and explode in worship and peace and harmony. And instead, you know what they did? They immediately started to fight. To fight over theology, to fight over practice. In fact, one described the different opposing groups as warring factions. And 5 years later, in the summertime, just a little bit later than this, in the month of August, 1727, Zinzendorf had thrown up his hands, and so had some of the key leaders, and they gathered together, oh, probably only about 600 people. I've been in the wood frame building. And they didn't know what to do. There was a brokenness and a desperation because the very thing that had called them into the story, they had largely lost. And then something happened. And the mercy of God, love encountered them again. And it hooked their hearts. One of them described it later, it was like unto Pentecost. Like what they read in the first chapter of Acts, in the second chapter of Acts. And then another said, very poignantly, we learned to love that day. And love got them to beginning to pray. And they got so excited, they didn't know when to end the meeting. And some people had to go put the kids to bed, and others just continued. And you know what? They prayed all night. They got up in the morning. They didn't feel finished. And so some of them fell asleep and some others took over and they prayed again. And so they started, not because it was a program or anybody told them that this would be an important thing to do or is a good way to keep people out of trouble or keep others in line. They started praying 24/7 in shifts. Anyone ever done that? And so they kept it going. And then they kept it going. And you know how long that prayer meeting went? 100 years. I've done a lot of things to try to get people to a prayer meeting. Even good coffee can't get people to a prayer meeting for a year. Only love can call them for 100. But it wasn't just prayer. They begin to see where this love wanted to go. And they begin to go out from this protected community until there were 30 some odd settlements just like theirs all over Europe and hundreds of small groups that were experiencing the same kind of reality. And then they begin to send out missionaries all over the world with this message of love that had captured their heart and restlessly wanted to go to the desert. One of the most powerful stories was when this love led them to a place we now call the West Indies. At the time, it was at the height of the horrors of the whole plantation system run by slaves. And someone had been exposed to it. They brought the message back and they said, love must reach these plantations. But they argued, they thought, but how can we get in? I mean, you can't just walk. These are private places. You can't. And then someone had this amazing idea. They said, let's sell ourselves as slaves to those plantations. Then they can't kick us out. And that's what they did. You know, folks, we use all sorts of motivating tactics. But only love can call people to sell themselves into slavery and call it the greatest privilege. I began saying this is a dangerous story. It's dangerous for me. I actually prefer to speak on other kinds of things because this gets too personal for me. It begins to hook into a part of my heart that occasionally I just like to sort of unhook, you know? I just love having a little bit of control over where my story is going to go. I mean, the least of my concerns is that it'll send me out camping. And yet, every time I unhook it, I have this desperate fear that I may not find the hook next time I want to re-engage. And so, as I get near this story, it brings back memories of times and places where I've said, God, I will trust you. Show me later what that means. And yet in these times of even reading the story, it starts to stir me. My bones start to make noises. They start to move around. And I quickly move to another passage. And yet, folks, there's no other story that works. Wasn't your own brilliant writer, Chesterton, who commenting on I guess a complaint against Christianity that had been tried and found wanting, and said, no, it's actually a little different. It's been found difficult and left largely untried. You see, no matter what our experiences with God, human nature, because it's the current of all the stories in our culture, are trying to lead us to a safe version of the story. One that's contained. One that we can celebrate in meetings. Ones that we can refresh ourselves and say, this was the story, wasn't it? To change the metaphor of water, it's like when we first come to Jesus, we construct this sailing ship and we go out onto the ocean and things happen out there, and then from time to time we draw back into the harbor. I especially know, I'm 64 this next month. I understand what happens to your body. I understand what happens to your mind. I understand that there's been wins and losses, and there's a great tendency sometimes to want to just sort of pull back from the poker game, sorry to use that analogy, and maybe just bet the minimum and see if we can keep some of our winnings. And yet Chesterton seems to be telling us the story is an all-in story. It's the only way it's ever been lived. It's a story of surrender. It's a story of trust. Not surrendering ourselves to odds or luck, but to the love that exists in God's heart and wants with us to change the world. But I've seen in my own tendencies and in our churches in North America, I can't speak to Europe, but I see how tempted we are to pull the ships back into the harbor, get them all fixed up and all shined up and polished up, and then moor them in the harbor and say, this is the story, isn't it? To celebrate the wonderful ships that God has given us. And we create great ships for children and for youth and say, come on, you can have a week. And man, we got a diving board in the back of this, you know. And we even got a zip line from one boat to the other. And it's fantastic. And it is fantastic. And actually, people experience God there, except all of those experiences stir something in our hearts and in our eyes. And we start looking outside the harbor. It's what love does. One of my favorite anonymous quotes is this one. Oh, ships are safest in the harbor. But that's not why we built them in the first place. We built them to explore the vast and endless sea. And there's almost no nation that understands that better than you. You know, in North America, Luke commented on this morning. We're losing 80% of our kids. We are losing, I'm not talking about of the culture's kids. We in the evangelical church are losing 80% of our kids by the time they reach adulthood. Is it anywhere similar in the UK? I don't know if you thought about this recently. That's actually serious. This is hugely serious. And I talk to a lot of younger people. I love hanging out with them. I love what they do to me. They challenge everything in me. And this is what I hear a lot. They get to about 18, 19, and often even before, because we lose half of them going into their teens. And, you know, they've been to our programs. Nothing as good as new wine, but I'm talking about North America. They've been to our programs, all the stuff we do. We've told them all the stories. They've had it all now. I mean, it's not just, you know, old days flannograph. I mean, we almost do holograms of Moses coming out. It's high tech, and we give them everything. And then at a certain point, they look at us, and they go, is this it now? Like, I've seen it all? Like, this is the story. And this is kind of what you want me to park in for the rest of my life? And we go, yeah. And they go, all right, you know what? I may see you again, I may not. But I'm going to look for a story worth dying for. I'm going to look for a story worth living for. Somebody has to change the world. I want to see if it can be me. And then they build a boat. And what's so hard for us is we did too. And we almost want to say to them, just a second. It's harder than you know. It's much safer, actually, to build great boats in here. Maybe people will come into the harbor. And if they do, we got all the mechanisms to get in behind them and usher them in. And yet something in their heart stirs them and says, you know, and it isn't even actually always that they reject God. But they need to find a different God. The God of adventure, who wants to partner with them to see if something in this world can change. You know, I'm 64, I lost a few ships out there, lived to tell about it, and I'm kind of presently renovating one of our present ships. I don't know if it'll ever sail very well again. And yet I see this hunger and this cry. So I feel the tearing. I want to warn them. I want to warn them how dangerous it is. I want to warn them that there might be safer versions of this love story. And yet I know that's not what they're asking from me. They may not have all the wisdom that I have, but they know it's dangerous. They're actually wanting to hear something else from me. And it's the words that Aragorn speaks to King Theoden at a desperate hour, when it looks like all is lost and everyone's huddled together in a small little room that's getting smaller, you know, as the movie frames run by. And Aragorn looks at the king, who's in the midst of saying, who would ever have thought I'd be the one to see the collapse, that it would be in my day that the story would end? And Aragorn says, ride out with me. This is what the next generations are wanting to hear in the church today. Ride out with me. Or better, I'll ride out with you. You know, I don't really know the way either. You probably got the better ship. It can take a few more hits. But I'm not going to ask you to stay home, and I'm not going to ask you to go alone. I'll go with you. Maybe I'll be able to help. Maybe at least I'll be able to pray and support. But this story isn't over until all the love that's come to us has reached the lowest and the farthest place. And may the story never find its rest until it has. Let's stand.